This podcast is from Christian Chapel in Tulsa, Oklahoma. For more information, visit us online at christianchapel.com.
It's good to see you. If you're a guest, my name's Chris. I'm the pastor here at Christian Chapel. And whether you're in person or online, we're thrilled that you're with us. We're winding down our fall series of messages called Exodus Stories, The God Who Saves. And so we've kind of worked our way through the story of the Israelites being called out of Egypt, called out of slavery, crossing the Red Sea, all the way through the desert, all the ups and downs that have accompanied that. And today we're actually going to flip over to Numbers chapter 13 and 14 and continue the story of the Israelites. They're going to be right on the edge of the Promised Land, and today we're going to talk about promises and problems. That there are times and seasons where God leads us into incredible experiences of his promises, and then we discover there are some problems along the way as well. So we'll learn from the Israelites that there are some things to do, some things not to do, and hopefully we'll learn from them so we don't have to go through some of those same experiences ourselves. How many of you have ever been in a new student or new employee orientation? Anybody sat through those, right? You start a new job, it's the wonderful meetings and different things, or as a new student. And in some places, they have this term they use for that called an onboarding process, right? Where we're going to try to get you on board with the rest of us as quickly as we can. And so in the onboarding process, you're trying to teach someone about the values, about the culture, and also just the practical day-to-day, this is what we do and this is how it works kind of experience. Now, Israel, we've said all along in the series, God is not just getting Israel out of Egypt, but he is also trying to get Egypt out of the Israelites. And so as you read through the rest of Exodus, you remember last week we left it where God is giving the instructions for the tabernacle and saying, I'm going to dwell among my people. And then if you keep reading it, he gives really detailed instructions about these are the materials that are to be used, these are some of the different things that are going to be done. Then you flip over to Leviticus, and the story of Exodus continues in Leviticus. Now, Leviticus is probably where your annual Bible reading plan goes to die every year, because it's the space where it's like the you're not going to touch this, you're not going to eat that, you're not going to do that, don't mix those fibers together. And there's all these things that just seem really kind of archaic and strange, and there's like instructions about defiling skin diseases, and if there's this kind of pus, do that, and if there's that, and you're just kind of wondering why is this in here? And then there's instructions about the priests and the feasts and the festivals and the offerings and all of these sorts of things. And you flip over to Numbers and the details continue. Now it's details about how many people are in each tribe and all of them. There's more about this is what we're going to do and this is how we're going to live. And it can seem really burdensome and you could think, why would anyone want to live this way? But what I want to remind us of this morning is that whole process from the time the Israelites see the first plague in Egypt to where we're going to pick the story up in Numbers chapter 13 this morning has been one long onboarding process for Israel. God has been telling them again and again and again, I've called you out not just to be free from Pharaoh, but to be free for following me. You're going to walk with me, you're going to live with me. And so all of the minutiae he gives them is not intended to crush them, but to comfort them. All of these details are intended to be a reminder of if God cares about what you eat and the clothes you wear and how you act when you're sick and how you interact with each other, and if he has all these details for how he's to be worshiped, if he cares about the small stuff, then he also cares about the big stuff. And so all of these laws and rules and regulation are intended to be like a security blanket for Israel where they know God sees us, he knows us, he loves us, he has a plan for us. And when we face a new problem, we're going to remember that, we're going to rely on that, and we're not going to turn and run away. So let's keep that in mind as we turn to Numbers chapter 13. This morning, again, we find the Israelites right on the edge of the Promised Land, and God gives some instructions to Moses. In verse 1, it says, the Lord said to Moses, send some men to explore the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the Israelites. From each ancestral tribe, send one of its leaders. Now, their journey is almost over. They're on the edge of the Promised Land. And God tells Moses, okay, now you're going to send these men in to check out the land. Now, a couple important things to notice here. First of all, God tells Moses, send these men to explore the land that I am giving to the Israelites. So their job going in is not to determine if or how they should take the land. It's simply to come back and describe what they saw. But God is reminding them, even before they go, this is my promise, I'm giving it to you. Now go check it out and then come back and give a report. But as we keep reading the story, you skip down to Numbers chapter 13, verse 27, it seems as if some of the men at least forget their job description. It says, they gave Moses this account. We went into the land to which you sent us, and it does flow with milk and honey. Here is its fruit. But the people who live there are powerful, and the cities are fortified and very large. We even saw descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites live in the Negev. The Hittites, Jebusites, and Amorites live in the hill country. And the Canaanites live near the sea and along the Jordan. Then Caleb silenced the people before Moses and said, "We should go up and take possession of the land, for we can certainly do it." But the men who had gone up with him said, "We can't attack those people. They are stronger than we are." And they spread among the Israelites a bad report about the land they had explored. They said, "The land we explored devours those living in it. All the people we saw there are of great size. We saw the Nephilim there. The descendants of Anak come from the Nephilim. We seemed like grasshoppers in our own eyes, and we looked the same to them." There's another translation that says when they go to the land, their report is, there are giants in the land. They have completely forgotten their job description. They've completely forgotten the orientation of the desert. They have forgotten the 10 plagues. They have forgotten that God parted the Red Sea. They have forgotten that he separated them permanently from Pharaoh's army. They've forgotten that he provides manna for them to eat every morning. They've forgotten he gave them quail in the desert. They have forgotten that he made water come from a rock. They have forgotten that he leads them by a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. They have forgotten that he has declared he is the God who's going to dwell among them. They've forgotten that he has said, these are all the details of your life, and if I care about this, I clearly care about the big stuff. And most recently, they have forgotten that before they spent those 40 days exploring the land, God had told them, go into the land that I am giving to the Israelites. And somewhere in that 40 days, 10 of the 12 men who go to explore the land adopt the mindset of, it's our job to determine if God's idea is a good idea. It's our job to go back and report to the people that, yes, the Lord might have led us this far, but now it's too uncertain. Now we can't go in. They forget their training and they default to this old, broken way of thinking. They fall back into the lie that if it's God's will, it will be easy. And if God has promised it, then we won't have any problems. But what we're going to see as we work through this story this morning is that promises and problems go together. Again and again and again and again, God promises and we experience problems. It seems as if the men loved the idea of the promised land, but they had expected that they would just walk into empty homes, empty cities, fields that had already been cultivated and were ready to be planted, or maybe even had a harvest waiting for them. They were offended that they once again encountered a space where they had to depend and rely on God. And so as we've said all through the Exodus story isn't just the story of what God did, it's also the story of what God is still doing. God is still calling his people out. He is still calling us into a new life. He is still not only setting us free from Egypt, but he is trying to get the Egypt out of us. He's trying to lead us into a new experience of complete and total dependence on him. And so one of the benefits for us of reading the Exodus story today is that we have the opportunity to try to learn from them without having to live through everything they experienced. Right? And this is the goal of the scriptures. This is how the Old Testament is used in the New Testament. They point back and they say, look what God did. Look how the people responded in a negative way. Don't be like those people. Right? Paul tells us this over and over and over again of, hey, you saw what your ancestors did. Don't do what they did. Peter tells us, don't continue on the empty way of life that was handed down to you by your ancestors. When we look back at the stories of promises and problems, what we're supposed to learn is that even promises have problems. So we're going to kind of walk through some of these ideas that we see in the Israelite story in Numbers 13 and 14 this morning. And I want to encourage you, think about the promises that God has made to you. Think about the problems that you've encountered along the way and let the Spirit speak to you about God's plan, His provision in every one of those spaces this morning. But the first thing we have to understand is even promises have problems. The Israelites have come to this test again and again and again of God has promised to deliver you, save you, lead you out of slavery into a promised land, but you're going to encounter problems along the way. Now, some of the problems that the Israelites encounter are the result of the spaces where God led them. He promised them something so He could lead them to a place and present them with a problem where they would once again learn to depend on Him. There are other problems that the Israelites face that are the result of the enemy working to destroy the promises of God. Now, in your life, God has promised you things. He's promised you hope. He's promised you joy. He's promised you life. He's promised you maybe really practical things of you're going to have a marriage that thrives. You're going to have children that serve the Lord. You're going to succeed in this area of school or this area of work. You're going to experience my grace, my goodness, my provision in all of these kinds of places. And we receive those promises and we love those promises and we want to experience them without any problems at all. Right, we want it to be the equivalent of God speak that we experience it and then we're good from there. But what often happens is when God promises something, He leads us into a new season, and sometimes it's the enemy attacking to try to destroy. Right, so for some of us, let's say in your marriage this morning, the reason you're having problems isn't necessarily you and it isn't necessarily your spouse. Sometimes it's the result of an enemy who wants to destroy your life and have ripple effects of destruction that flow through your children and flow through your family and your friends and do damage to you and to God's name and God's glory. Right? Some of our problems are the result of the attack of the enemy, and some of our problems are the result of God saying, "This promise is so big, I need you to trust me all the way through it." And so we have to lay down this idea that, well, if God has promised it to me, then it's going to be easy, it's going to be fun, it's going to be, life's just going to be up and to the right. Because a lot of times what happens is when God promises it, those first couple steps, that's what we're experiencing it. Right? When He calls the Israelites out of Egypt, remember what their first experience is. They see the plagues fall on the Egyptians. They're protected from all of them. And then one night, God sets them free. And as they walk out of Egypt, the Egyptian captors are literally coming and giving them gold and silver and all of the good things from their homes and their flocks and their herds. And the Israelites have to be thinking, the promises of God are pretty awesome. Right? Like, how many of us, if God called us into something and the response of the people around us was like, do you need money? How about my car? Would you like my car? Do you want one of my kids? I'll give you one of my kids. What do you need? I'll give you whatever you need. Those are the moments where you're like, hey, this following Jesus stuff, that's pretty awesome. Right? This is the week after you get engaged where you're just like, everything I've discovered about you is just thrilling and it's just wonderful. And that's good. God gives us these good gifts because He wants us to embrace the promise. He wants us to chase the promise. He wants us to pursue the path He's laying out for us. But somewhere along the way, the promise is going to have a problem. And when it has a problem, we have to decide, does that mean that the promise was not true? Or does that just mean I've got to trust God in this space? And so the Israelites, they come to this test over and over and over again, and they keep failing because they think that promises are proof of a failed promise. They think, well, God promised to bring us out, but I guess He didn't know about the Red Sea. God promised to bring us out, but I guess He didn't know that we'd get hungry. God promised to bring us out, but I guess He didn't know we would need water in the desert. Each time they face a new problem, they take it as a proof of a failed promise. And so again, we want to reject this way of thinking. We want to go in with a realistic understanding that problems are not proof of a failed promise. They're part of the process. Last Sunday, we told you about Crisis Pregnancy Outreach, and they're stepping into this amazing new season of ministry. So if you don't know what that is, CPO is an organization started by members of Christian Chapel. They serve women and babies affected by unplanned pregnancies. For 37 years, they've been serving women and families in Tulsa. And for the past 10 years, they've officed out of Christian Chapel. But God has recently spoken to the leadership of CPO. He's given them a promise of, I'm going to establish you in a new freestanding location. I'm going to increase the number of women and babies you're able to minister to. And I'm going to put you in a place where women will be drawn to the hope and healing and salvation that they find in that space. Now, that's a wonderful promise. And so we have found the place. It's on 61st Street, right there by 169. It's an ideal location. It's beautiful. And yet, here's what's going to happen for CPO. They're pursuing the promise. God is providing. We said last week, we're given a $100,000 matching gift to help establish them in that place. But with all of the provision, with all the promise, and with all of the celebration, CPO is going to have problems. There's going to be hassles. There's going to be headaches. There's going to be new bills to pay. There's going to be a new budget to raise. All right, there's going to be new ministry opportunities, but new ministry opportunities mean you look around and say, we need more people to serve. We need to figure out how to train them. All of these new promises are going to have some problems with them. And the temptation we face in those moments is to think, well, Lord, you didn't tell me about this. You just said it would be better. And why is better seem so hard? Why does better cause me so much stress? Why does better mean I'm constantly saying, I don't know what to do, I don't know how to do this? But in those moments, CPO is going to remember, in those moments, you and I are going to remember that problems are not proof of a failed promise. They're just the next space where God works. And sometimes, many times, the reason he allows those problems to come is to remind us that his promises are never going to lead us past our need to depend on him. Right, you never promote past dependence on God. And now, when you were in high school, the goal was for you to graduate and get out of there. Right? When you went to college, the goal was to graduate and to get out of there. When we take sometimes that same approach with the Lord of, hey, I'm going to walk with him, I'm going to depend on him, but someday, God, I would really like to get to the place where I can just look at you and say, I got it from here. Right? Been married long enough, I've arrived, and Lord, we're good. You go worry about some of those other people. You know, I've raised enough kids, now I know how to do this. I've worked in this job long enough, Lord, I know I can do it. And what we want to say, God promises us the promised land. We want to say, okay, give me everything I'm going to need for every step of the journey in an abundance, all that I will ever want, imagine, or ask for, and let me have it right now and see how it's going to end, and then, Lord, I will follow you on that path. But again, going back to last week, what does God tell the Israelites when he establishes the tabernacle? I'm going to make my dwelling among you. God calls the people of Israel out, not to be completely free and autonomous. He calls them out to be completely dependent on him. And God's desire in your life and God's desire in my life is that as we pursue his promises, it leads to a growing dependence on him. We're not trying to achieve our independence and move out of the house and tell him we'll see you at Christmas and Easter. But we're trying to grow in an increasing relationship with him. As we read through the story of the Israelites, we see that their problems seem to be escalating in relationship to the promises that they're experiencing. So when they're in Egypt, slavery is their biggest problem, right? Because God has promised them freedom. And then they get to the Red Sea, and they have this promise of, I'm going to separate Pharaoh from you forever. Now they're stuck between his army and the sea. And then God leads them out the other side, and they have this promise that I'm going to provide for every need, but then they start to run out of food and out of water. And now they stand on the edge of the promised land, and God has promised, this is the land I'm giving to you, but they come back and say, but there's giants there. The land itself devours the people who live there. How can you possibly do that for us? And it's a reminder to us that the bigger the promise God makes to you, typically, the bigger the problems that are going to be associated with it, and the bigger the provision you're going to have to trust God for. Now, the first part of that, we're all about. I want big promises. And yet, as you read through the scriptures, the overwhelming message is, then get ready for big problems. Right? Aren't you glad you came to church today of like, Lord, bless me? Problems? I don't want problems. I want promises, and I want provision, but I don't want problems. And we tend to believe this lie of, hey, there will eventually become a point in life where I am promoted past the problems. I will succeed enough. You know, so for me as a pastor, it's tempting for me to look around at pastors who I might think are more successful than I am. Maybe their church is bigger, or they're better preachers than I am, or they're better leaders than I am. And it's tempting for me to look at them and think, I just wish I could be where they are, because they've got all the promises and all the provision. But what happens is every time I get to know them, I also discover they've also got all the problems that come with it. A couple years ago, I was invited to a basketball game over at ORU. Actually, it was with President Wilson. He was hosting some local pastors. And didn't know you were going to be here, but good to see you. So promise it's a good story, not telling bad ones about you. But, you know, so President Wilson, he hosted this group of pastors, and I don't know how, got in there. I think snuck in a back door or something. And so we're there, and it was the first time I'd met him. He hadn't been to ORU very long. And so he started asking me about Christian Chapel, and I was telling him who we are and what we do and all these kinds of things. And he was asking me, what are you trusting God for? And there were some things that we were really believing the Lord for that to me were massive problems and needed massive provision. And so I was telling him, and he was being really encouraging of, hey, God's going to do that. You can trust him, be faithful. And then I started asking him about ORU. Hey, what are you guys doing? What are you working on? And he started telling me about these projects at ORU. And, you know, there are times where you're trying to play it cool, but inside your head is exploded. Like, I had just told him about some of my $100,000 problems that I was really trusting God for. And he started telling me about these $10 million problems. And I was just like, oh. And so he talked me through. And I remember at one point he mentioned they were replacing the turf on the baseball field. And he told me how much it cost. And before I knew it, I had just blurted out, oh my goodness, that's expensive. And I didn't even know. And he just kind of laughed. And he said, Chris, everything here is expensive. Like, and it was just that I have come back to that thought over and over and over again, because it's reminded me of this truth. The bigger promises God gives you, the bigger problems you're going to face, and the bigger God's provision is going to have to be to see that promise fulfilled. You're never going to outgrow your need to depend on him. Because it's easy for me to look at President Wilson and say, man, that guy's arrived. All the promises and all the provision. But then you talk to anyone in those moments, and what you find is, and all the problems, right? You might be sitting there holding one baby or waiting for that first child, and you're just thinking, man, I wish I could be like that family over there. They've got the 5 kids, and man, it just seems like they've got all the promises and all the provision. Go to their house. They've also got all the problems, right? They've got all the household. They've got all the spaces where they're saying, we don't know. Lord, please help. Again and again and again and again, God keeps leading Israel into these experiences to help them understand no matter how big the promise, there will always be big problems that accompany it. And sometimes those problems are coming because the enemy is trying to attack and destroy, and sometimes they're coming because God is trying to teach and to lead. But either way, our job in those moments is to keep our eyes on the promise and the provision and not be distracted by the problem. You see, for the Israelites, they're standing on the edge of the promised land. For 40 days, they're waiting for these 12 respective men, one from each tribe of Israel, to come back and describe this land they've been dreaming about. And as they're waiting, they're so excited to hear the report. But then when they come back, what is the report? Hey, the land is full of giants. The land devours the people who live there. We look like grasshoppers in our own eyes and to them as well. You see, the problem they had was not the problem they faced. It wasn't that there were giants in the land. It wasn't that there were fortified cities and strong armies. It wasn't that there were spots where the land seemed to devour the people who lived there. Their problem was their perception of the problem. The Israelites had given in to the same temptation you and I face when we encounter problems on the path of God's promise, where they had decided, okay, here's what we see. For 40 days, they march around the land, and every time they encounter a new city, a new fortification, every time they see a new large group of armed men, every time their problem grows bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and at the same time, their view of God's promises shrinks smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. So by the time they show back up, they have this massive problem and this tiny little promise. And it has shrunk their view not only of God, but of themselves. You see, who are the people of Israel as they stand on the edge of the promised land? In their eyes, they say, we're grasshoppers. We are weak. We are powerless. We can be driven away by a strong wind. But in God's eyes, they are the chosen ones. They are the called out ones. They are those who've been redeemed from slavery. They are those who've been led across the Red Sea. They are those who've drank from water from the rock in a desert. They're the ones who've been provided manna from heaven. They're the ones that God has spoken clearly to. They're the people he's chosen to make his dwelling among them so that all the world may know the grace, the glory, the power, and the might of God. That's the identity they are supposed to remember as they encounter the giants in the land. But instead, they choose to let their problem become their reality. Now, you and I, we don't use the same language. We don't say, I'm just a grasshopper, right? Because everyone would be like, what? But we have different language. We use the language of, I always and I never. God promises and we're following him on the path of the promise. And then here comes the problem. And we think, I always have this happen to me. God tells me he's going to do something, and I start following him on the path, and then it all falls apart. I never get an easy road. I always am the one who blows it at the last minute. I never trust God all the way through it. I'm always the one who loses my temper. I'm always the one who lacks faith. I'm always the one that people attack. I'm always the one that the devil schemes against. I'm never the one who succeeds. I'm never the one who has victory. I'm never the one who walks in faith. I never have courage. God never comes through. I'm always and I never. And in effect, we're saying, we're just grasshoppers. What are we going to do? The problems are too big and the promise is too small. But what we are supposed to do is the same thing the Israelites are supposed to do. God has been orienting their lives all through their desert experience to remind them, this is who you are. This is how I work. And for you and I, it's the same thing. When we have been following him on the path of his promise and we encounter the problem and it grows bigger and bigger and bigger in our eyes, our response is, I know who I am here. I am the possessor of the promise. I am the chosen one of God. I'm the one who's been called out and set free. I am the one that the Spirit has spoken to. I am the one that God has provided for. I am the one that he has proved himself faithful to over and over and over again. I am the one that even when I was faithless and failing, he remained faithful and came through for me. I am the one who's known his provision. I'm the one who's known his salvation. I'm the one who has seen God work for me and through me again and again and again and again. So this problem will not distort my reality of the promise God has laid out or his provision that I know is coming. Promises and problems are going to go together in your life. We don't always know how. We don't always know why. We can't always explain if was this the enemy attacking or was this God sending this. All we know is that for every promise God makes, there will be problems, and for every problem we face, God will provide. So in that space, then, we realize we have two choices we can make. When God has promised and we're facing problems, we have a flight or a fight response. And we see both of these here in the stories of the Israelites. So 12 spies go in, 10 of them come back and say, let's run away. Two of them come back and say, God has promised it, let's stay here and see what he does. All right, so if you flip over to Numbers chapter 14, we see first the flight response. It says, that night, all the members of the community raised their voices and wept aloud. All the Israelites grumbled against Moses and Aaron. And the whole assembly said to them, if only we had died in Egypt or in this wilderness, why is the Lord bringing us to this land only to let us fall by the sword? Our wives and children will be taken as plunder. Wouldn't it be better for us to go back to Egypt? And they said to each other, we should choose a leader and go back to Egypt. I mean, this is Israel's most common response. From the day they're delivered until they possess the promised land. Every time they face hardship, their response is always, hey, we should go back to Egypt. You know, hey, we're stuck by the Red Sea. Let's just go back to Egypt. We're hungry. Let's go to Egypt. We're thirsty. Let's go to Egypt. There's an enemy. Let's go to Egypt. There's giants. Let's go to Egypt. Again and again and again, they want to go back to the place of safety and security, even if it's also a place of slavery. They'd rather stay with what they know than trust God on an uncertain future and facing these insurmountable problems in front of them. You know, sometimes when I'm studying for a sermon, I come across a resource that just describes something so much better than I ever could. This week I came across a video that I think accurately summarizes both the Israelites' response to problems and our response, of just that natural default response of I'm just going to turn and run away. All right, so this is the image, this is the thought that I want to stick with you in the coming days when you face problems. Can you throw that up for us, Mallory? Just over and over and over again. This is us. There it is. Nah, I'm not doing that. Right? Just again and again and again and again and again. Now, if you're a parent of a toddler, you are almost positive what's happening there. That's definitely either at nap time or bedtime. And they have taken that child in the room and they have told them, go to sleep. Please, if you love me and Jesus loves me, go to sleep. But then this is the child, everybody has one, some of us have multiple, that's the escape artist, and that is always convinced of at nap time there is some grand party going on that I'm missing out on. So I've got to come out and see. Angie and I, we had one of ours that did this, and so we would do that exact thing of put him in bed, and then you would close the door, and you would walk around the corner in the hallway, and you just wait, because you know they're coming. They're doing it every time. And what happens? That exact thing would happen. They would come out. You would step around the corner. They would have the, and turn and run right back in. I love it because it's just our default response. It's one of those, we do it without even knowing what we're doing. And for the Israelites, again and again and again, their response has been, when they face a problem, to immediately run away. You and I, we have some of this same struggle in our own life. And so we have to reach this point. Before we can stand and fight, we have to just stop running away. The first step of faith is not, hey, let's go. The first step is just, I'm going to stand right here. You know, the Israelites, God wasn't calling them for the spies to come back. He knew what the report would be. He knew there were powerful people in the land. He knew there were fortified cities there. He knew the report would cause some fear in the hearts of the Israelites. But the response he wanted was, well, God has called us here, so let's just wait and see. For some of us, though, we have embraced the default of running away for so long that we have fled in the opposite direction of so many of God's promises. And so my hope for you today is maybe you don't even know you're doing it. But just to stop and evaluate of, Lord, when I face a problem, is my first response to get out of there as fast as I can? Or is it to stop and say, okay, Lord, if you have called me here, then I believe you're going to work here. And sometimes it's going to require other people calling us out and calling attention to, hey, you know what you do when life gets hard? You run away. You hide. And running away looks different. Sometimes it looks like apathy. Sometimes it looks like silence. Sometimes it looks like anger. Sometimes it looks like fear. Sometimes it looks like I just don't believe that this is really what God called me to, so I'll go back over here because it should have been easy. But we need people to come in our lives and to call us out and say, hey, you know what you do? You always run away. The Spirit will speak through them. We need someone to call attention to our default responses. When Angie and I, our youngest girl, Audrey, she's 11 now, but when she was, I think, maybe 4 or 5, I think it was right before she started going to school. She discovered and was really good at rolling her eyes when you talk to her. I mean, just like, and you know, there's an eye roll, and then there's like the eye roll that is also a head roll and a body roll. And she had embraced the whole rolling process. So you would be talking to her, and if she didn't like it, it was the like, right? And would just sigh. So one day I'm having a talk with Audrey, and she starts rolling her eyes at me. And I stopped. I'm like, Audrey, stop rolling your eyes. Just stop. You're getting ready to go to school. You can't behave this way. You know, just a nice, rational, calm parenting moment. So then we're trying to now move on and address whatever it was. And she rolls her eyes at me again. And then she does it again. And then she does it again. Each time I stop and say, Audrey, stop rolling your eyes at me. And this is now, I mean, I know you're all better parents than I am, but it has now progressed past a nice, calm, rational parenting moment. And I've decided this is the hill I'll die on. Like, I will not eat again. We will not sleep until you are able to listen to me talk without rolling your eyes. And so we're having this talk, and I think the rest of the family is starting to hear it. And at this point, like, she does it again, and I finally tell her, Audrey, stop rolling your eyes at me. And she looks at me, little 4 or 5 years old, and goes, I don't even know what that means, as she rolls her eyes and falls back on the couch. And I, like, in that moment, I honestly just cracked up, because it was just like, oh, you're not terribly disobedient. You just don't know. Let me show you. This is the face you make at me all the time. Stop doing that, right? And it was just like, oh, that's rolling your eyes? Yes, that's rolling your eyes, right? But for some of us, we've got to get to this point. Like, nobody has ever spoken truthfully to us and said, hey, you always run away. Stop running away. Stop running away from difficulty. Stop running away from hardship. Just because the class is hard doesn't mean you drop out. Just because the job is difficult doesn't mean you get your resume together. Just because the relationship isn't as fun as it used to be doesn't mean you walk away and find another one. Just because the addiction is pleasurable but hard to beat doesn't mean you just decide this is just who I'll always be. You have to stop running away. And you have to stop and stand and fight. And you're not going to fight in your own power. You're not going to fight in your own strength. You're just going to say, Lord, if you've called me here, then I believe you have a plan for me here. So I'm going to wait and see what you will do. As you flip down to Exodus chapter 14, verse 5, you see the response of Caleb and Joshua. It says, then Moses and Aaron fell face down in front of the whole Israelite assembly gathered there. Joshua, son of Nun, and Caleb, son of Jephunneh, who were among those who had explored the land, tore their clothes and said to the entire Israelite assembly, the land we passed through and explored is exceedingly good. If the Lord is pleased with us, he will lead us into that land, a land flowing with milk and honey, and will give it to us. Only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not be afraid of the people of the land, because we will devour them. Their protection is gone, but the Lord is with us. Do not be afraid of them. Now, Joshua and Caleb are only two of the 12 spies that go into the land. But notice what they do. They remind the people, this is God's promise. Those who were filled with fear, not only had they said, hey, we can't go in, they had tried to denigrate the promise God had given to them. They came back and told the people, yeah, it flows with milk and honey, but it also devours the people who live there. Their message was, God is taking us into a dangerous place. We can't trust him there. But Joshua and Caleb, they come back and they've determined we're going to stand and we're going to fight. We're going to wait and see what the Lord does. And their first response is, hey, listen, the land is exceedingly good. The reality is it is a land flowing with milk and honey. It is a land where our children will be established for generation after generation. It is a place where we will shine like a city on a hill, where we will be God's chosen people for all of time. This is where he's called us. It's a good space. And then they attack those fears, but the people are there and they're big. They say, no, 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 their protection is gone. Their gods are small. Joshua and Caleb know that Exodus was the story of the battle of the gods, and God always wins. So they're believing if he's called us here, clearly he's going to provide for us. Really, what they're asking the Israelites to do, they're not saying you don't be afraid. They're not saying you shouldn't be worried. They're saying we've just got to face our fear, and we've got to be willing to fight. We've got to stay. If God has called us here, if he has promised us, then we've just got to stay here long enough to hear what he wants us to do, and to faithfully obey the next step he puts out in front of us. For Joshua and Caleb, they did not deny the problems of the land. They weren't denying that the people were big and strong and powerful. They were just choosing to remember that God was bigger, stronger, and more powerful. And that if he had called them to this point, Joshua and Caleb remembered their orientation. We are the chosen ones of God. And if he cares about every detail of our life, then he cares about the problems facing us right now. And if he's called us there and said, this is the land he's going to give to us, then we're just going to wait and see how he does it. But there comes that point. You never overcome fear for as long as you run away from it. There has to come the point where you just decide, I'm just going to stand here. Right? When an addiction you have is revealed, it's a scary process. And one of the ways the enemy tries to keep you in that addiction is by telling you it's too dangerous to let the light shine here. You can control it as long as it's inside of you, but once you let it out, you don't know where it's going to go and how far the ripples will be. So just keep it there. And that fear causes us to run back into our addiction, to believe those lies. But what God is telling us is, hey, just stand and face it. Trust me, if my promise is freedom, that means freedom from that addiction as well. So you're just going to have to stand and face it. You're not going to know how the whole story ends, but you've got to stay there and just trust. Every family has certain values and certain things that they hope to instill in their kids before they grow up, right? And some of those are serious and they're important, and some of them are just kind of unique to your family. So like for Angie and I with our kids, there are things that our parents instilled in us that we want to instill in our kids. And there's the big important ones. Like we want them to love Jesus and we want them to love other people. We want them to be men and women of integrity. We want them to look out for those who are overlooked. We want them to use their gifts and their abilities for the glory of God and the good of other people. We have all of these really like good, holy, Christian parent values. And then we've got this other little pile of things over here that are important to us for no other reason than they're important to us, right? And you probably have some of those. Like for us, it's all of our kids are going to know how to drive a stick shift. Does that matter in the grand scheme of life? Yes, it does, or else it wouldn't be one of our values, right? Just, hey, no child of mine is ever going to see a car and be like, I can't drive that, right? So we just, like, my grandpa did it to my dad did it to me. You're going to know how to drive a stick shift. And so we've got that one. We've got dumb ones, like you're going to know how to water ski. Again, probably not a life-altering thing, right? A little challenging when you don't have a boat to teach your kids to water ski. But you're going to figure it out. Why? I don't know, because we can. And if they ever go out, we don't want them to be the ones like, I don't know how, and I'm 30, right? So we just decided we're gonna do that. This is what they're going to do. Like our kids, they're all going to have good shooting form, right? And you're like, guns? No, free throws. So, you know, they're going to know balance, eyes up, elbow in, follow through. Like these are important things for us. They're going to know how to throw a ball and catch a ball. They're going to know how to hit a ball. They're not going to look awkward. Again, you do you, we'll do us. It's weird, I know. And then we've got this one that I don't know where it became a thing. Actually, I do know where it became a thing. But at some point in our life, Angie and I decided none of our kids, there are no Dow children who are allowed to be scared of roller coasters. Just not a thing, right? And I'll tell you exactly where it came from. Two experiences. One, in high school, I was at Worlds of Fun in Kansas City with a group of my friends. And as we're walking around, there was the one kid who just refused to ride anything. And I just thought, man, you are bringing shame on your family. Like, I question your ability to succeed in life. Probably going to wind up in prison, right? And so you just kind of have all of these, like, I don't know. None of that was justified. I'm sure he's a wonderful person and doing well today. But just had that first thought as a teenager of no child of mine, right? And we've all got our no child of mine statements. No child of mine is going to be scared of a roller coaster. And then we came to Christian Chapel. I was a youth pastor, and we took some kids down to Six Flags one summer. And we would do this trip kind of every year. And every year, there would be a couple kids who would go with us. And they would buy their $75 ticket, and they would get in a church van in the parking lot at 4 a.m. in the morning on a Saturday, and they would ride for 4.5 hours down to Six Flags, and they would go in, and it'd be 110 degrees, and you're just baking off of that asphalt, and we would walk around, and we'd buy our $27 hamburgers and all of this kind of experience, and they would not ride a single ride for the entire 12 hours we were there. And then they'd get back in the van late at night. They'd drive all night. They'd get home, and they'd come home. And I always wondered, what's that conversation like with your parents? Hey, son, I just spent $150 for you to go to an amusement park. What'd you do? Well, I walked around, and I sat on a bench. And I was so deeply offended, but now it was not an offense of what this said about a person. Now it was a much more practical offense of a parent. How dare you waste your parents' money? They spent some, now, but now I understand of like, hey, as a parent, I'll spend $150 to send my teenager away for a day. Do what you want with them. I don't care, but hey, all right, have fun. You're alive? Good. All right. But I get it. But at that point, it was just like, again, and I would come home and tell Angie, our kids are riding roller coasters. You know, and so I know, like, with the roller coasters, there's a height requirement. So for some of you, you might have had to wait till you were 7, 8, 9, 10, 14 before you were tall enough to ride all of the rides. Well, God blessed us with tall children. So they all got to confront this fear very early in life. I mean, they were 4 and 5 years old, and it was like 48 inches? Get on. You know, and in each case, sometimes they always said they were excited. But then as you got closer and closer and closer, and Angie and I, we're building it up of this is going to be so much fun. You're going to love it. You're going to love it. You're going to love it. So much fun. It's going to, and then you get closer to the promise, right? And you get up in the front and you start to get through those chutes that are actually inside the building. And now you can see the people getting on. You can see them shooting out. And you can see where they're going upside down and they're going around in circles. And then you see the ones that come back in and the little kids have the tears coming down their face. Right? And in that moment, some of you parents, you're kind and compassionate. And your kid says, I don't want to do it. And you're like, that's fine. And in that moment, Angie was kind and compassionate. They said, I don't want to do it. And she said, buddy, you're going to. And they turned to me and they said, Dad, I don't want to do it. I'm like, that little girl just got off and she was smiling. Is she tougher than you? Right? To different parenting approaches, but both for the same goal. You are not going, we don't care if you love it. We don't care if you want to ride them again. You're just not going to be scared. And if you're scared, you're going to overcome it. You're just going to do it. Now, there are those parenting moments that you have in life where you kind of, again, stake your claim of this is the line and I'm just not bending. And then later in life, you're thinking about it and your kids are like telling the story and you apply some kind of like spiritual application to it to justify some of your poor parenting choices. Of like, well, you know, son, what I was really trying to do there. I was really trying to teach you that you never overcome fear without facing it. I was really trying to teach you that when God promises big things, sometimes there's going to be big problems. And in that space, there's going to be some big fear. And there's always a chicken exit. And you can see those other chickens taking the exit. Right? And you can see them walking. And they're mama's boys. And they're just like, she's just, and it's just like, but you're not going to be there. You know why? Because you're a man of God. Audrey, you're a woman of God. He has called you and equipped you. We're not among those who tuck tail and run. We're those who stand and strap in. Let's go. This is what we do. Right now, the reality is, I don't know why. In some stubborn way, I just decided my kids aren't being scared. You're not wasting my money. Get on the ride, right? But it reminded me this week as I was reading the story of Joshua and Caleb. They're standing there and they're the last line of defense between Israel being obedient to the Lord and walking into the promised land and Israel being disobedient to the Lord and being banished back to the wilderness for 40 more years. And they stand there and their plea is not, hey, we can do this. We're big enough. We're strong enough. We've been equipped. We've been challenged. Their plea is the Lord has promised and he will be with us. They're taking all of their stance on, we don't know how, we don't know why. We just know our job is just to stay here. We can't take that chicken exit. We can't take the easy way out. We've got to strap in and we've got to see where this ride leads. And they took that position from a position of faith, believing, yes, it's a big promise. And these are the biggest problems we've faced to this point. But we're believing there's a bigger provision coming. We're believing God has not called us here to leave us here. Right? They're trying to get Israel to transition their thinking from those who always think, let's just go back to Egypt, to those who begin to think, my obstacles are God's opportunities. The things the enemy throws up, these are just places and spaces where God is going to provide. And you and I, we've got to make that same transition in our heart this morning. Our obstacles are God's opportunities. They're places where he works, places where he moves, places where he goes to bat on our behalf. So I want to encourage you this morning as we wind up just to think about what are the promises God has made to you? What are the things he's promised to do? Where has he promised you freedom? Where has he promised you joy? Where has he promised you thriving relationships? Where has he promised that he's going to provide for every need? Where has he promised to save, deliver, and heal? Where has he promised that, hey, take that step of faith, I'm going to be with you there? Where has he given you big dreams? Where has he given you big visions? And where are you experiencing big problems? And in those spaces this morning, I want to encourage you with the words of Moses in Exodus 14. The Israelites are on the banks of the Red Sea in Exodus 14. They don't know. They see Pharaoh's army coming. They see the sea in front of them. They have no idea. It's just another time where it seems like God's promise led them to an impossible problem. But Moses tells them in Exodus 14, 13, do not be afraid. Stand firm, and you will see the deliverance the Lord will bring you today. And this is my encouragement to you. If God has promised it, he will provide for it. There will be problems. Don't be taken off guard. Don't be pushed back. Don't run away in fear. But just make the decision. I'm going to stay right here until the Lord directs and the Lord provides. I'm not going to be those who forget my identity and who let a problem cause me to run back to my old way of life. Will you stand with me? I want to pray for you. The band's going to come and lead us in a final song this morning. Jesus, we come today and you see the struggles that some of us are facing as we pursue your promises. Lord, we know that you've spoken. We know that you have led us to this place at this time. We know you've led us to these relationships. We know you've put these dreams in our heart. We know that vision is from you. We know those words that were spoken over us were confirmed by the scriptures, were confirmed by others in our life. But now, Lord, we stand on the edge of your promise, and all we see are the giants in front of us. All we see are the reasons it can't happen, it won't happen, it shouldn't happen. And Lord, we're praying in this space that you will remind us of who we are. Remind us that we are not those who shrink back, turn away, and run back to Egypt. Remind us, Lord, in this space, we are possessors of the promise that you have spoken, you have declared it, and it will happen not because of us, but because of you. Remind us, Lord, that you are the faithful one. You are the true one. You are the Lord who leads, the Lord who guides, the Lord who protects. You're the Lord who delivers. You're the Lord who heals. You're the Lord who sees the end from the beginning. You're the Lord who leads us on every single step of our journey. And so, Lord, as we face our problems this morning, we ask that you would remind us of the promise and that we would begin to see your provision. Will you begin, Lord, to fill our hearts with faith, to just stand and see what you're going to do. Lord, I pray for those that they've been waiting, they've been longing, and even this week, they're expecting answers to some of the promises you put in their life. Lord, I pray as they stand full of faith and courage by the presence of your Holy Spirit, that this will be a week of provision, that this will be a week of answered prayer, that this will be a week where they hear your voice and they obediently follow the path you're laying out for them. Lord, we ask that you would fill us with hope and courage to just take the next step of obedience, to believe you, to follow you, and to walk with you. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thanks for listening to this podcast from Christian Chapel. For more information, visit us online at christianchapel.com.